Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. How are you? It's a happy VE day.
Yes, happy VE. We had the jets fly over my flat about an hour ago, but I guess the other kinds of celebrations are all virtual now. But yes, happy VE day.
Yeah.
Right. So we are in week whatever of lockdown, both in the U.S. And the U.K., although some states are seeking to reopen on a variety of different levels and timeframes in the days and weeks to come. And one of the things I think we're seeing is tensions between the state governments and the federal government over how opening up or returning to normalcy or whatever the term is, what the time frame is, and who has the responsibility to make those decisions. A crisis in federalism, if you will.
Yeah, I would say, sorry, David, if I can interrupt, given yes. Our current location, this is not unique to the United States. So for example, here in the UK, we're awaiting a speech by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Sunday evening, which, if some of the leaks are to be believed, will concern relaxation of some of the restrictions here in the UK. But we saw some pushback yesterday from the Scottish First Minister saying, not so fast, these won't apply to Scotland. And we're seeing echoes of the American debate going on here. And there's a lot of talk about a four nation strategy here in the UK in its response. And this crisis, of course, is a transnational one, and I think it's underscoring tensions, constitutional tensions in political systems around the world between nation states and their various jurisdictions.
To be sure, right? I mean, it's a global pandemic, but it's also a hyper-local pandemic in some ways with conditions different in different places.
And so that's right.
Figuring out what the right response is tricky, and I think that's it's exposing this question of where the power rests to make decisions, and the questions of federalism really are sort of at the root of much of American political history, has to do with these questions of federalism and how much power rests with the federal government, how much power rests with state governments, with local governments, and with the people. But in the UK context, we got four nations. In the US, we've got 50 plus the District of Columbia plus Puerto Rico plus a few other places. How does this sort of constitutional and revolutionary background of the United States help to explain the sort of particular crises we're facing right now with federalism?
How did we get into this mess?
Yeah, it's your century that got us in this mess, Frank. So you fix
it. It is my century. The thing to bear in mind about the American
thing with the United States, Frank, it's all your century's fault. So responsibility.
By extension, it's my fault.
Yes, exactly.
the thing that we have to understand about the Americans or the men and women who created the United States back in the late 18th centuries, they were extremely distrustful of government. And to some extent, and we can talk about this in your century and beyond, David, this has remained in the DNA of the American Republic. And so there's an inherent distrust of government on the part of the American revolutionaries. And they believe that the answer to that, they basically believe that governments will, if governments are given power, they will eventually abuse that power, and they will threaten the rights of citizens. And there's a sort of libertarianism with a small L, I guess, enshrined in many of the institutions created by the revolutionaries. And they get around, and one of their solutions for excessive government power is to keep power as much as possible in the hands of the people. And they believe the best way to do that is to decentralize power. So the problem with the British Empire was that an aggressive government in London was aggrandizing power and money from the periphery and abusing the people who lived in the colonies. And so in response to that, the initial response of the revolutionaries is to keep power local. And that's why Americans enshrine power in their states originally. Jefferson famously said, Virginia is my country. We don't think of Virginia as a country today, but early Americans did think locally. And the first Constitution of the United States, the Articles of Confederation, was very much the best way to think about it, and historians have demonstrated this, is not as a constitution, but as a treaty treaty between separate sovereign states. That didn't work very well for all kinds of reasons that need not detain us here, and I don't think it's the details are terribly relevant for us today. But the response to the failings or the limitations of the Articles of Confederation was to create the federal government. But even in creating the federal government, which was very strong, I mean, Americans in 1789, after the Constitution is ratified, end up as citizens of a much stronger central state than they had been when they were subjects of the British Empire in 1770, for example. So it's one of the ironies of the American Revolution. But even despite that, there are limitations throughout the American Constitution, the federal Constitution, which we currently have, on the power of the federal government. And so this skepticism about centralized power is part of, as I said earlier, the DNA of American political culture down to this day, and there's a real distrust of government. So when President Trump a month or so ago said that he had all the power, basically supreme power, to decide whether the country opens up again or not, he got pushback not just from his usual critics, but also from the right, because people on the right said, no, we can't have that. And he backed off that within a day or two. And
then he said it was entirely up to states to make decisions.
Well, he's been all over the road on this one, because he's been saying, as the states have sought to deal with the crisis, well, this is on you. You deal with it. It's nothing to do with the federal government. Most people would not accept that interpretation of the Constitution either. So he's been all over the place, and we might talk about that. But my point is the legacy of the revolution is skepticism about the federal government. And the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, so the Bill of Rights is added to the Constitution after the Constitution was adopted, and the first amendments a guarantee right to free speech and freedom of religion and the right to bear arms and right to a fair trial, etc. But the 9th Amendment says, look, any rights that have not been enumerated in this Bill of Rights, the people still have, because they're one of the concerns about the Bill of Rights was, if you start to enumerate rights and you leave something out, you might not, by implication, you may not have those rights. So it says, no, you don't have that. And then the 10th Amendment is crucial in this interpretation, I think, at this moment, because the 10th Amendment states powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, I think there are a couple of things there I want to unpack before I hand things over to you. Those powers are reserved to the states respectively. That is to say that any powers that are not explicitly given by the Constitution to the federal government are the states, reside in the individual states. But I think the or to the people is interesting, because we've seen in the past 20 or 30 years, and we'll probably talk about this, the rise of sort of 10th Amendment enthusiasm, especially on the far right in the United States. But that's often been by the people. So these have been either, we see the rhetoric used by militia groups, for example, or like the armed militia group that occupied the Michigan State House a week or so ago, saying that, the 10th Amendment gives them the rights because these revert to the people. And what we're seeing in the current crisis, I think, which is really interesting from a constitutional standpoint, is, if you will, there's a division going on at the state level in some states. So I'm thinking about places like New York or California, where there have been lockdowns in place for early on and for a pretty prolonged period of time, between the action of the state and the action of individual people who might be resisting those restrictions. And so we have a kind of intrastate, not interstate, intrastate debate, kind of grounded in this distinction in the 10th Amendment between those powers residing with the state or the people. And we're seeing the state and the people kind of at loggerheads in certain areas of the United States. Meanwhile, we have this larger federal question. So sorry, that's a long-winded introduction, but I think it was important to set the stage. So that this legacy, when we hear states' rights through American history, it's not without foundation, in the sense that the states have a kind of standing in the U.S. Constitution that's fairly unique in a lot of federal systems. The federal government is supreme, but its supremacy is limited. How does this play out in your sanctuary, David? I'm sure there won't be any problems with it, right?
Well, just a few thoughts I had just listening to you talk about the 18th century part of this. I mean, one is obviously that the states precede the federal government. And I think
yes. that
matters, right? So they have a tradition and a constitutional standing that precedes the Constitution itself.
Well, the states that matter to, like Massachusetts, go ahead.
Yes, but even so, the idea of the you know states as being a sovereign and the sort of the idea of sovereignty being sort of divided in various ways is embedded in the whole system. And the Constitution, when it sort of talks about the way in which power is divided both within the federal government and then between the federal government and the state government, it's really murky in a lot of places, right? Like where the boundaries between these things are, where there is exclusive jurisdiction, where there's concurrent jurisdiction, and where exactly, you know, the Constitution and the laws are supposed to be the supreme law of the land, except when they're not. And, you know, it's, you know, you mentioned the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, which are ones that don't get adjudicated very much, but are clearly very important here. I mean, there's some other parts of the Constitution that seem relevant that also don't get talked about very much. Article 4 of the Constitution, which most people forget it is there, you know, which has to do about the relationships between states with each other.
Yep.
You know, and there's some really interesting gray areas in there.
Yeah, so what does Article 4 say, David?
Article 4 is about is basically how states relate to one another. And there's sort of two big sections to Article 4. There's the full faith and credit clause in Article 4, which is about states recognizing the decisions made by other states. And even though it seems like this seems to be a blanket coverall, the way it gets applied in practice, it can be very murky. You know, for instance, states tend to recognize marriages performed in other states, unless they don't. And we can think of multiple occasions historically in which states have decided not to recognize marriages performed in other states, whether it's interracial marriage or whether it's same-sex marriage, where states say, oh, well, yes, we recognize all the marriages from our neighboring state except for these ones. And there's some other weird stuff having to do with, you know, if somebody contracts a debt in one state, but they do it for gambling, which is illegal in another state, can you collect the debt and all these other kinds of things? So even it's a, you know, they make a statement about how states are supposed to relate to one another. That can be both clear and murky. You know, your driver's license in Massachusetts is valid everywhere else you use it, but your hunting license isn't. You know, and
so, the driver's license one is interesting, David, because that's as a result of, I think it's a 45 state compact where 45 states have banded together to recognize each other's driver's licenses. And there's an interesting precedent there, because one of the responses we've seen to COVID-19 has been some of the states in particular regions banding together and creating compacts, and those are theoretically prohibited by the Constitution, but actually constitutional law Supreme Court decisions since then have allowed for state compacts, for example.
Yeah, so that's Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, which has to do with interstate commerce compact, which says, you know, as you point out, the Constitution says Congress needs to approve those. But then in 1893, as you point out, the
Virginia versus Tennessee.
The Supreme Court said, that only applies if it's like something important. If it's something small, then they can do whatever the hell they want. So if we think about the Port Authority in New York, for instance,
right,
is an example of this, where New York and New Jersey get together to handle the port. Lots of rivers and waterways have interstate agreements that are sort of compacts along this line. The court says, yeah, those are fine. You know, Article 4, going back to Article 4, though, there's also the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which has to do with basically saying that you cannot deny basic rights to people who live in other states. So you can sort of freely travel through the country and get afforded basic rights as a consequence. The courts have sort of waffled on this as well, that saying, well, actually, in some ways, states can privilege their own citizens in some ways. So there are places in the Constitution where this whole question of federalism is very much nailed down and how power is divided, but other places in which, you know, the language itself is kind of fluid, and the way it's been interpreted has been both inconsistent and sometimes difficult to sort of navigate. Obviously, though, when we get to the 19th century, like much of the story of the 19th century is about where the strengths of state governments lie, where the state of federal governments lie, what is the barriers between them, what responses do states have to federal laws they don't like, you know, and that starts in some ways actually at the very end of the 18th century with the Alien and Sedition Acts and the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, you know, which have to do with states arguing that they had the power to nullify federal laws that they didn't think were constitutional.
Although I mean, you're right. That's what the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions say. And they're adopted by Virginia and Kentucky in response to the Alien and Sedition Act. You're quite right. But I think the kind of part of this story that often gets neglected is none of the other states. So these were resolutions. They weren't legally binding. And secondly, those resolutions were circulated to all of the other states in 1798 and 99, and none of them endorsed them.
Oh, to be sure.
So one can interpret the failure of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions as a kind of comment on federalism at the turn of the 18th and 19th century, because they're often seen as presaging the Civil War, of course. And this is especially important because the authors of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions are Jefferson and Madison. Madison's a main architect of the Constitution, so his interpretation really matters. But I wonder if they haven't been given inflated – if we haven't kind of missed the point of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which is their failure.
I mean, I think that's I think they have legs, though, because that sort of doctrine gets used and sort of evoked at various other points throughout the 19th and 20th centuries by this idea of sort of either nullification or interposition of the state, you know, between state and the federal government. Obviously, nullification becomes a big deal in late 1820s and 1830s when South Carolina tries to nullify the tariff and there's that whole fight with Andrew Jackson. Obviously the main question in which the state authority and federal authority comes into play throughout at least the first half of the 19th century has to do with questions of slavery, where state authority ends, where federal authority begins, where they have overlapping authority. You know, at various points in time, when we think about who is in favor of a strong central government, oftentimes in those cases, slaveholding states wanted a strong federal government to be able to reclaim fugitives, slaves who had run into so-called free states. We can think about the Fugitive Slave Act and what have you. And there are interesting fights that sort of break out over exactly where state authority ends. And where federal authority begins. We have, you know, there's a case in 1842 in which Pennsylvania has these personal liberty laws that the Supreme Court says are unconstitutional. There's a case in 1854 in which the Wisconsin Supreme Court says the Fugitive Slave Act was unconstitutional because it violated the sort of laws of the state of Wisconsin. And the Supreme Court said, no, Wisconsin Supreme Court, you can't do that. And the Wisconsin legislature said, no, U.S. Supreme Court, you can't tell Wisconsin what to do. And so there's sort of a back and forth over where exactly power rests. You know, and there's lots of sort of practical questions, you know, throughout the 19th century in which are this question of where does authority less rest, you know, even after we get the question of slavery resolved in the Civil War. And obviously the Civil War is one enormous crisis in federalism. In the late 19th century, there are a huge number of fights over the railroad regulation, who gets to regulate interstate commerce and where interstate commerce begins and where it ends. But one of the things that you see generally is that as the power of the federal government grows, these fights change in nature, right? So in the 19th century, when the federal government is relatively small and doesn't intervene as directly into the lives of individual people and in terms of economic impact, as the federal government becomes more powerful, these questions become even more pronounced.
Yeah, it seems to me, David, sorry to interrupt you, but you know, so on one hand, the Civil War is the turning point because that seems to be a moment where the supremacy of the federal government is made clear, especially on this fundamental question, which has been the fundamental question in American life since the Declaration of Independence, which is what is the place of slavery in this republic and enslaved persons. And so that seems to be solved in 1865, although, as we know, it's more complicated than that. And then what we see in the late 19th and early 20th centuries with the rise of a much stronger federal government, beginning during the Progressive Era, but particularly gaining speed in the 1930s. And there's resonances with what we were talking about last week with unemployment and the federal government intervening in a massive way directly in individual people's lives, that the debate is revived again. And it takes on a different hue. Would you agree with that? I mean, I'm trying to take a kind of 30,000 foot view of this.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, you know, the Progressive Era, when you have sort of ideas about what nationalism is and the role of the national government in terms of breaking up trusts, in terms of regulating interstate commerce, I think that's vitally important. And obviously the 1930s, you know, one of the things you see with the New Deal is a much more direct relationship between people and the federal government without being mediated by the states. You know, so we're thinking about the Social Security Administration is a direct relationship where a person is being recognized as a citizen of the United States and therefore is having, you know, face financial relationships as a consequence of that. We think about like the income tax, you know, going back to the Progressive Era, you know, that's a very direct relationship with an individual person and the federal government not being mediated by the states in the way that tax structures prior to that didn't. So I think you're right. Those are the sort of the two, you know, critical moments in terms of in, at least in the 20th century, of shifting towards a sort of more, much more power being centralized in the federal government. What's the, you know, thinking about how this all sort of fits together with the COVID-19 crisis? I mean, we've had, you know, in recent years, much continuing crises or structures. What are the other big fights over federalism that are running concurrently with the COVID-19 fight?
I mean, I think, and this obviously directly relates to COVID-19, but the healthcare has been one of them. I mean, I think healthcare and education are two of the really crucial ones. You know, the Affordable Care Act has provisions in it that make it incredibly complicated because states were allowed to opt in or opt out of the system depending on local circumstances, and that's in part because of opposition to the actual act itself, but also it's a legacy of this tradition, if we can call it that, in the United States of federalism and states retaining their rights as they see them. So I think that's been running at least for a decade, and frankly since the Clintons brought up healthcare reform, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago.
You have to flesh that out, because we've got these exchanges that people are supposed to purchase insurance of, and you've got state exchanges and you've got a federal exchange, and some states have decided to not make their own exchange, so people have to use the federal one, and you know, it's kind of a mess.
That's right.
And a system that anybody would design intentionally that way.
No, that's right. And it's a mess because in order to get the legislation through, they had to make these concessions at the state level for certain states.
Thinking about the discussion we had last week about unemployment, the structure of unemployment insurance is a similar kind of.
That's right. We mentioned that.
Cooperative, but not particularly effective. Well, at least in normal cases, it's effective, but right now it's not.
No, and the level of benefits is different in different states, depending on what those states think. And as you say, it's a federal-state partnership. That's a little different because it's a federal-state partnership, I guess. And education is another key one. You know, the world we work in, both tertiary education at the university level, but right down to primary school, really, or elementary school, because there are, you know, that this is a power that's generally reserved to the states. And in fact, often local communities within states. However, there's so much federal money, federal government money in education, that the federal government exercises control over, to a certain extent, or can, over what goes on in the states. But there's pushback in a lot of states to that. So I think the, and again, I was thinking about this in anticipation of this conversation, David. It's not unlike, however, what we see here in the UK, for example. So two of the areas that are devolved powers of the that the Scottish government has are in medicine and education, and so those are, yeah, and these are things obviously that people, you know, that individuals, you know, that's where they encounter the government most commonly, and you know the notion that local control by definition must be better is
and policing
is not uniquely American.
That's to be sure. So the two that struck me in addition to the healthcare one about places where this is still, you know, really ongoing fight, and in some ways in which the Trump administration has also weighed in at various places. One has to do with marijuana legalization.
Right.
You know, where you have concurrent, both back in the day, you had concurrent state laws and federal laws, which tended to agree with each other about at least basic principles about the legal status of marijuana. And then as various states have liberalized their laws and the federal government hasn't, you seem to have a disjuncture between the federal law, which says that marijuana is illegal, and state laws, in fact, that say it's legal and regulated in a variety of ways. And how do those two things play together or not? And clearly, they don't. I mean, there's not a way to sort of square that particular circle, that at least that I can ascertain. And I guess the other one has to do with immigration, where various localities have decided they're not going to cooperate with federal law enforcement about enforcing national immigration laws, and these get called sanctuary cities or what have you. And I think there's a tension there about you know how the state and federal governments are supposed to work together, and what are the levers of power that the federal government then has over states that are reluctant to play along with whatever agenda they have.
And President Trump has attempted to use the distribution of PPE in response to the COVID crisis to sanctuary cities. Of course, there's no correlation between the two, but he said if your states have sanctuary cities, you might not get PPE because we shouldn't be basically spending public money on this equipment to the benefit of illegal immigrants. Which is a contrast to, say, Portugal, which for the duration of this crisis has extended all the rights of citizenship to all people resident in Portugal, regardless of their legal status.
Right. Yeah. Checking people's papers is not conducive to social distancing.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make sense in a public health crisis, arguably.
No. But. And I think these are sort of fights that they're not going to go away anytime soon. I think there's a you know, fundamental tension in the sort of structure of the American system that makes resolving these extraordinarily challenging. I mean, you can imagine we're going to have continued fights over immigration policy and where the sort of responsibility there rests and how police power works. I think you're going to have continued fights over drug legalization and how that works. And you know how extensive the federal government's reaches into the lives of people in the states. You know, when we think about to when the Constitution's drafted, the federal reach is extraordinarily limited in terms of the kinds of ways in which everyday people would be in contact with the federal government. And now, at least the potential is for the federal government to be involved in people's lives in a fairly routine basis, even if it's in fairly subtle ways.
Well, the U.S. doesn't currently have the capacity and it, in response to COVID to use one of these apps to trace all of our connections and have us tested. Arguably, that's what's necessary, as we've seen this in South Korea. We've seen constant testing and retention of data in Germany, and these countries have responded, are among the most successful in responding to COVID. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the technology existed in the United States and had been circulated widely and testing was widely available, there inevitably would be pushback from people saying we should not be giving this information to the federal government.
Oh, to be sure.
Yeah, and not just on, you know, I think it would come from across the political spectrum. There'd be reluctance to even give it to state governments, I'm sure. But I think that we don't live in a world where that's actually even on the table yet. And that's going to be a problem for the recovery of the United States. But this tension between the states and the federal government is ongoing. I mean, I'm not perplexed. I can explain why President Trump has responded as he has. I think he's responded as he has because he doesn't understand the crisis. He doesn't understand the kind of science behind the crisis, and he responds impulsively. You know, he's a day trader. He responds to whatever the day's story is, and you know, he's not thinking strategically, and he's concerned and obsessed with his reelection. So I think that explains his. But his responses have not been ideologically consistent. Whether he's declaring one day I own the country. To the next day saying, look, it's on the states. It's all, you know, you sort yourselves out. You get your own equipment. He's been incredibly inconsistent on this, which I think has placed his supporters in a difficult situation because on one hand, many of them apparently want the country reopened. Many of them, the states where his support is strongest or happen to be the states where the outbreak is not as prevalent yet as I suspect it will be in future weeks and months. And so they're kind of stuck ideologically because he hasn't been consistent on who can do what. They tend – I mean, I think his support is broader than the people who've turned up to sort of liberate the Michigan State House, and I'm using liberate with air quotes here. It's broader than that, but they represent the point of the ideological spear, those people who turned out with their long guns to liberate the state house. But he's not giving them a kind of ideologically consistent position.
No, he's not. And I think in part because he, you know, has a political notion of a unitary executive. He has a political notion that the president really is a sort of a national CEO of a kind. I think he sees governors sort of as like division heads in a corporation that the CEO can sort of instruct to do what he wants, which is not how the federal government works or how federalism works. At the same time, I think he doesn't want to take responsibility for something that's going extraordinarily badly with, you know, the loss of tens of thousands of lives. He doesn't want to take responsibility for that, so I think he wants to transfer responsibility to other people. So he wants the power but not the responsibility.
So after we get through this, David, whatever this is,
yes.
And who knows when that will be, what do you think the federal-state relationship will look like? I guess if we're, you know, when I gave you the kind of 30,000-foot view a few minutes ago and I said, well, okay, we saw during the Progressive Era this happened. You know, we got the Civil War, the Progressive Era, then the New Deal. And all these are kind of key moments in the history of the relationship between the states and the federal government. I think we're in another one of those potentially. What do things look like 10 years from now in terms of state-federal responsibility?
That's a really good question. This is a global health crisis, and one of the things that struck me is the extent to which countries are not working together as much as they could, right? And part of that is because two of the major world powers, the United States and the UK, have over the past 4 years decided to step away from global partnerships that they've been instrumental in over the past half century, whether that's the UN, NATO, the EU, what have you. And I think that sort of it speaks to sort of the problem about how different political organizations relate to one another, how do they cooperate when they have problems that they're facing in common. one of the things I think we're seeing a lot of right now is a lot of, and we mentioned this briefly earlier, lots of relationships between states where the states are working together to solve the regional aspects of this particular crisis. So we've got a sort of a band of states in the West Coast. We've got a band of states that's like New England and New York. We've got Southern states who are working together to, on a variety of levels, you know, trying to say, okay, we're going to speak with, if not one voice, at least be on the same page about when we're, when things are going to reopen, what the timeline for that's going to be. I wonder if we don't start to see more of that. I mean, there's the question then of sort of what is the federal government's role in a health crisis like this? You know, and if you were to ask James Madison what's the federal government's role in a health crisis, he would probably say there isn't one. But we live in a very different world than James Madison did. Right.
Yes, I'm always, and this seems contrary to my own personal and professional interests as somebody who works on the 18th century. Who cares what James Madison would think about the global pandemic? You know, we worry so much about originalism and what did the founders think about this?
He doesn't know about germ theory. So
no, exactly. Know. So I mean, I know you know this, but I'm always slightly mystified by this.
Well, and so I think that speaks to sort of the dynamics of how federalism is a. You know, it's not only a sort of murky system, but it's an evolving system that, that is predicated upon sort of the ability of the state to use power in complex and subtle ways. Because on the other hand, having no federal response to this seems just ludicrous, right? I think we need to have a really robust federal response in terms of tracking people, in terms of doing testing, of providing supports for states. You know, one of the questions that, that Mitch McConnell has come, responses that Mitch McConnell has had to all of this, is he says, well, maybe we should just have states declare bankruptcy, which currently states can't do. And that maybe that might be a solution to some of the short-term budget crises that are resulting from all this. Now, the consequences of that would be astronomical on the economy and on the rights of workers and pensioners and all other kinds of things. You know, and sort of the part of what I think McConnell is suggesting there is that the responsibility is ultimately up to the states, and if they can't do it, then oh well, then they can sort of write it off. But I don't think that's a, I think that's a really disastrous solution personally, but I think we're going to have a serious debate, you know, in the aftermath of all of this about, you know, what role the federal government has and how states can relate to the federal government. So if your answer has been like, what's going to happen in 10 years after all this, you know, I'm hoping we don't go back to the situation beforehand, because the situation beforehand, I think, was built on a huge amount of both goodwill, which clearly falls apart when people don't always act out of goodwill, and based on political norms that once they get ignored are hard to enforce.
Well, norms by their very nature, you know, once you stop adhering to them, they cease to be norms.
Yeah. And I think so much of American politics is sort of predicated upon, you know, both a, you know, on the one hand, there's a written constitution and a written set of laws and a kind of clear rule book, but then there's also, you know, layered on top of that, just a huge set of norms that have largely been adhered to for most of American political history, and if they get ignored, then it's hard to see where the breaks are.
I mean, I think, not to answer my own question, because I want to think about the current moment a little bit more. So if I can back up slightly in order to get to an answer to my own question, in a different world where the president, other than President Trump, I think the response of the federal government to this crisis, I think there could have been a coherent state and federal response to this, which is the federal government via the CDC would have, and the pandemic response team on the National Security Council would have alerted the president to the problem in December and January. as they attempted to do. The CDC would have provided advice both to the federal government and to the states, which is its role. It would have worked with the WHO to get testing kits out at an appropriate time. And the federal government would have coordinated the response. The states would still have had, because the states have a lot of responsibility for public health. That's a legacy of the progressive era. The states could have taken responsibility and implemented policies locally in conjunction with the advice they were getting from the federal government. The federal government would have been able to source PPE internationally appropriately. And so the system, there is a scenario where you say, okay, this response wouldn't have been so bad because the states and federal government could, as the system intended them to do, have worked together reasonably well. There would have been frictions around the edges, but that's one scenario. So maybe a decade from now, we're there. We're back to there, where people say, actually, we don't want to do that again. Or maybe we're in a situation where these compacts of states act almost as regional confederations. Good history of that.
Oh yeah, that's always worked out so well in the past.
And so if states that have common interests like the West Coast and the Northeast want to get together and operate one way, and the states of the Southeast continue to want to neglect public health, well, then you could have something like that. But there is a possibility for the system to work. But you're right, it depends a hell of a lot on goodwill on the part of the people who are acting, and we don't currently have that.
I mean, I think you can envision the alternate reality in which, Hillary Clinton is president, or someone sort of analogous to her, where, the federal government is providing support to states that they need and helping them get ventilators and PPE and all these other kinds of things as it's able to. And isn't either, claiming complete authority over everything or saying they have no authority for anything and it's entirely up to the states to handle it themselves, and have a much more sort of balanced conception of how federalism is supposed to work. But that involves a very different political reality than the one we're in.
It's not only that, David. I mean, that's a scenario, with a president, Hillary Clinton. I think that you sketched that's one way to go. The other, but there are things President Trump could do that wouldn't even require him to compromise on his own beliefs or values, such as they are. So, for example, when he visited that factory in Arizona the other day and refused to wear a mask. It's been demonstrated. There was a study recently that if 80% of the population wears masks, it goes a huge way towards cutting down the transmission of the disease. And so his bully pulpit as a leader and leading by example is not part of the Constitution, but it's part of the political system. And he missed that opportunity, especially with his supporters who are frankly skeptical about this disease and who live in areas that are about to be hit by it.
And there have been multiple cases in the news recently of people engaging in violence when asked to put on masks and entering grocery stores and other businesses and claiming that the disease is fabricated or what have you. And that's, I'm worried we'll see more of that as things unfold. Right. Well, that's a depressing note. We had some last drops of some things that are probably silver linings on the world we're in, Frank. What do we got?
Yeah, well, I just want to give a shout out. I might have mentioned this already, but I want to praise and recommend Serena Zabin's book on the Boston Massacre, The Boston Massacre of Family History, which was published a month or two ago. It's really a fabulous book. It's a great, great book. And Serena looks at the British occupation of Boston beginning in 1768 down to the Boston Massacre and passed it through 1770 and so on. But what's really original about this book is it's really a social history of the soldiers who were sent to Boston and their more importantly, of their families. It's really – it's a great book. So I just want to give a shout-out to Serena Zabin and her book on the Boston Massacre. It's a, if you're looking for something to read while you're locked down, I can strongly recommend that.
Yeah, she was part of the History Festival a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
Yeah, and she did a great talk about it, and the sort of the amount of sort of digging that she did in order to sort of trace who these families are and where they're living and all that kind of stuff was really, really astonishing.
Yeah, it's great.
What about you, David? So I want to endorse just two things. The first is Caleb McDaniel just won the Pulitzer Prize for history for his book Sweet Taste of Liberty, which is about an enslaved woman who fights for basically for reparations of a kind, a woman named Henrietta Wood. And it's a really interesting sort of micro history that about the ways in which questions about slavery and freedom and what is owed to enslaved people, was a active fight in the 19th century. So congratulations to him for that. It's a really, a great honor to be able to count yourself among the Pulitzer Prize winners. And I also wanted to endorse Ox Ears, which is the Oxford Early American group. One of the sort of silver linings of this pandemic, if there are any, is that lots of things that were previously you had to go and be in things in person are now going online, so you can participate even at a distance. And so this Early American History group at Oxford is they're doing Zoom groups, and they had Larry Hatter recently, shortly this week, talk about his new book project. He actually came to Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago, or months ago, before all this. It was good to hear him give the updated version of his project. But if you're interested in Ox Ears, there's a PhD student at Oxford, Grace Mallon, who's running it. And it's sort of a great way to have a, intellectual community that sort of extends beyond the local. There are people there, other people from Edinburgh, in fact. There were people from the United States who were participating. So we're going to be able to create virtual intellectual communities all around the world. Right.
Excellent.
Until next week, Frank, stay healthy and cheers.
You too, David. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.